are we moving people up? And are we doing that with any kind of adverse impact? Are we doing that with parity? Are we offering pay? And that's complete remuneration. So pay, benefits, weight, you know, everything.
Right.
Are we doing that with parity? Then are we using any kind of artificial intelligence to tag individuals who would be marked for performance improvement plans? Or do we have humans that are in between that and that? Are we using artificial intelligence to tag people for reductions in force? Are we using talent intelligence to go ahead and potentially look at lateral moves? So I think one of the things that, you know, we're talking about skills-based hiring so much.
This is William Tinkoff and Ryan Leary of the You Should Know podcast. We got Andrew Gadomski on today. So we're going to talk about all kinds of fun stuff around AI and compliance and auditing and ethical, moral, I don't know, all kinds of good stuff. And especially as it relates to compliance and some of the governmental actions, both here and abroad. And Andrew's an expert and love his analytical mind, wish I had half of it. And so why don't we just start there? Andrew, what's going on in your world? What are you doing?
Yeah, so it's been an interesting ride over the last few years, both pre and post pandemic. As some people might know, in December of 19, Aspen was asked to come into the federal government and work with the Workforce Planning and Strategy Group within the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. So this is the cyber arm and the security arm of the Department of Homeland Security.
Right.
At the same time, we started really exiting out of, let's call it, dashboarding.
Right.
So since 13, you know, we started doing, you know, centralized dashboards and data lakes and cloud. You know, we were doing that for a long time. And there's like a point where, you know, you kind of see the writing on the wall that, you know, we went from dashboarding to gap analysis and risk analysis. And there's like a point where it's like, okay, you don't need to do that anymore, because you've been, if you're not doing it by now, if you haven't bought into the concept, you're not going to do it.
Right.
Right. If you're not using data to make decisions by now, you're just not. So that's fine. So, we got
We're
out
just
of
waiting
the,
for those people to die is pretty
yeah,
much
yeah right. You're just waiting for those people to leave.
Yeah.
So right. We kind of got out of that business and started doing more root cause analysis. And at the same time, we're working with the department. And then I had some medical stuff. Candidly, I'm a person with epilepsy. A lot of people don't know that.
Didn't know that.
It was dormant for 35 years, and then it wasn't.
Wow.
And that is a bizarre twist to a lifestyle. You know, no driving, no swimming, no walking. I mean, there's all kinds of weird stuff that was going on. I had to figure that out. And so it was easy for me to move into the government full time. They had an opening. They say, well, would you like to do this full time? And I said, sure. But there was a contingency. So I was able to keep Aspen as a business
right.
at the same time, but I had to flip it. I couldn't do workforce planning and strategy and root cause analysis for others while I'm doing it for the federal government.
That's fair.
And so we moved and I moved the business, and I was slowly moving it anyway into auditing. And so now what we're doing is we're looking at we're fortunate that we're able to kind of turn the ship. Which I think was actually easier for us because we were already working in other companies' data. Right? We're already hooked into their networks and working on their laptops and looking at Workday and Phenom and everything else. A lot of people know that we've been doing that a long time. So we're focused in on, are companies using artificial intelligence? And if they're doing that, is it efficient? And then same thing, but then compliance started to come up. And there was mandatory, there was enacted legislation that wasn't, there was pending legislation that was waiting to turn on. There was drafted legislation that was waiting to turn on if it got approved. And the same was happening for pay equity and wage transparency. Mm-hmm. So we saw an opportunity to exit the analytics business and move into the auditing business. And so now we've got customers that, you know, we are behind their firewall and we're looking at their usage of both. You know, are they exposing their wages the way they're supposed to be? Right. Are they executing pay equity the way that they're supposed to be, both legislatively and in terms of, you know, just de-risking their organization? And then I think what's more recent is, well, everyone's using AI. What the hell does that mean for employment and recruiting? Are we doing the right things? And I think what we've kind of run into, and I think we're probably going to go down this path anyway, is that no one quite knows what the landscape looks like for AI. There's right. a bunch of techs out there who are saying, we got it. And I think that if you start with those techs, that's great. I think that what you're trying to do and what we've learned to do is you've got compliance risk and you've got reputational risk.
Right.
And so there's a group of employers who are saying, I don't need to do this until someone gets slammed.
Right. Right.
And then there's another group of employers who say, I'm going to do the right thing. And rather than looking at diversity and inclusion, equity and accessibility as a page on my website, I'm going to show it with data. And I'm going to do it for real, because that's what all this artificial intelligence legislation is about. It is about ensuring that individuals and underserved or protected classes are not being discriminated against, or automation is not leaving them behind or advancing others in an unfair way. And so I think, you know, that's what's been going on. And I got to tell you, that with all this talk that we're seeing, and you guys see it, oh, people are, you know, pulling back on diversity and inclusion, mm-hmm. you know, we're starting to lose leaders. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. If there was a time, and I call it ABIDE, accessibility, belonging, inclusion, diversity, and equity. Okay, ABIDE, which is kind of like a cool pun, right? If there was a time to dig into this with data, it's now. Because now you're just, it's not even about the EEOC. You're getting slapped around based on your revenue. And I can't believe people are trying to back up out of EDIA. I mean, I'm like, this is the one, you want the seat at the table? This is the one that actually links back to shareholder value in the street.
Yeah, what should they be looking?
Go ahead, Ryan.
What should they be digging into?
So there's the pre-employment processes, right? So you're, I call that the AEIOUNY, applicant evaluated interview by the manager, offers unnecessary, meaning that you don't have to advance them, and yes, okay? So easy to remember, right? You want to look at the different stages of those and how we're doing on conversion, and you want to look for adverse impact.
Right.
Right. So you want parity. So, if you don't know what adverse impact is, go Google it. Right. But, you know, but you have to look at that first, and then you have to look at it in terms of not just conversion, but speed.
Yeah.
And unintended consequences. What's that?
It said unintended consequences as well.
Right. And so it's good for operational value, but that's the first thing you want to look at. Then I think the next thing you want to look at is this pay equity issue. And this is really outside of the control of your average TA leader. You know,
right.
You know, talent acquisition, you know, isn't they're in the we help hiring business, but they're not in the we do a lot of personnel actions of employees business.
100%. Yeah, it's not their role.
Because it's financial. It also touches ops and finance.
That's right. And so
a little bit out of their hands.
It's a little bit out of their hands because the you know, you talk to your app, and you guys know a bunch of them, but you talk to your average talent acquisition leader, you know, they can't, you know, the only reason they know about separations is because the reactive response is we have a vacancy now.
Right.
Right.
Right. So they're not looking at, they're looking a little bit at mobility, but they're not executing career ladders and designing, you know, knowledge, skills, abilities, and tasks. They're not doing that stuff. So when you're looking, so you have to look at your pre-employment processes. But now with AI, you have to look at your decision processes based on internal mobility, such as promotions. So are we moving people up? And are we doing that with any kind of adverse impact? Are we doing that with parity? Are we offering pay? And that's complete remuneration. So pay, benefits, weight, you know, everything.
Right.
Are we doing that with parity? Then are we using any kind of artificial intelligence to tag individuals who would be marked for performance improvement plans? Or do we have humans that are in between that and that?
Mm-hmm.
Are we using artificial intelligence to tag people for reductions in force? Are we using talent intelligence to go ahead and potentially look at lateral moves? So I think one of the things that, you know, we're talking about skills-based hiring so much. Okay. You've kind of hired all these people. Yeah. So great. You've hired all these people. And now you have a skills taxonomy. So you're going to use the skills taxonomy to figure out, well, I'm a project manager. Can I go work as a project manager in another division? So are you going to rock and roll on AI to make that decision based on the skills taxonomy?
Right.
And just automatically assign that person and they rise to the top? Or are you going to have humans involved? And if you are, where and did you document it? And so everything I just talked about, from mobility to pay equity to the transparency to the exits to the change of workforce. We didn't talk about reorganizations. That is so beyond the average talent acquisition leader. And that's because it's just not in their scope.
Right.
And what's bizarre is you look at a company like Workday, and they just acquired HiredScore, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So good for Athena. That's awesome for her and her group.
100%.
How long do you think it'll take for Workday to wrap that in their one ecosystem model, make that for the pre-employment processes, then to find another company that'll do performance management and tax skills taxonomies and have that rope into artificial intelligence? Not 100%. That.
Not only that, is 2 weeks prior to that, they put $250 million into Paradox.
Right.
So there's another hook there, but we'll digress on just Workday and kind of their stuff. But I want to get your take on audited AI and ethical AI. And in particular, what I want to kind of unpack with you is, this is 2 years ago, so it's a little dated. I only could find one HR tech vendor in the world that had third-party audited AI, meaning they had hired a university, they gave them all the data, they paid them a ton of money, and they gave them all the data, and they said, is it doing what we say it's supposed to be doing?
Right.
And if not, what needs to be, you know, calibrated, recalibrated, et cetera. I don't know of anybody else that's doing that. I know a lot of folks that do it internally.
Right.
Which I believe is, you know, who's watching the chickens in the chicken house type stuff. Like, I don't believe in that particular model. I think if they're going to do it, then it should be third party. That's my own personal belief. The ethical part, what I want to get your take on an ethical AI, is who's best positioned to actually say what ethical AI is and isn't as it relates to work.
So
take this wherever you want to go.
So first of all, ethical AI, you know, that's kind of like saying computers.
Well, they're all based, well, at least as I understand large language models in this particular instance, is they're all based on their moral code.
Right.
Right? There's morality to them. which I'm not sure I like or not.
So, but ethical AI is also, first, it's around the data coming in and are you using that data in a responsible way in terms of insulating where the data, the people or the individuals or the companies that contributed to the data.
Is responsible in your mind at that particular point subjective?
No, I think ethical artificial intelligence, ethical AI does not include sensitive and personal identifiable information. It doesn't include any data that hasn't been voluntarily disclosed. Open source intelligence. I mean, so there's some of those basics.
Some of those are teetering on legal, though. That's illegal, right?
But that's part of it, right? Okay. So part of it is we have a structure as either a deployer of artificial intelligence. So this is a company that's deploying somebody else's, or we're a developer.
Right.
Well, if we're a developer, how do we train this? And did we do that in an ethical model? Did we get our data from the right places? In addition to ethical, is this secure by design concept?
Right.
So did we actually, now that we have this data that we're training, did we actually put a shroud around it in a secure environment? Because that's part of the ethics, is that safe, right? The ethical AI is also making sure that we're taking steps in terms of healthcare, finance, high risk areas, and saying, what guardrails have we put in about what we are going to do and aren't going to do as we take this artificial intelligence and apply it to the vertical?
Mm.
So ethical AI in healthcare, when we're looking at it in terms of identification of cancer cells or forecasting models around vaccine or so on, there's a different set of ethics associated with those applications than say we're going to use artificial intelligence to determine what is the mortgage rate percentage we are going to offer to Andrew, William, and Ryan versus whoever.
Mine would be higher.
I'm at 13-14%.
Yeah. Andrew's probably got the best one.
I'm interested to get go ahead and finish your thought, and I'll come back.
So I just think that the first thing is that this concept of, you know, we've had some vendors kind of come out in the HR space and say, here's our ethical AI statement.
Yeah.
Excellent. Just disclosure, you know, understanding that you have a problem and stating it out loud is the first way to get past a problem.
Denial. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So I think that's great. But I think that the ethical use just within employment is actually pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. I think it's around non-discrimination, making sure that personnel actions are done responsibly, that you've locked up your data, that you haven't trained it poorly.
I'm assuming you're baked into the transparency to where the company, either using a product and they're transparent about what's going on, or you're transparent to candidates or otherwise, but there's a transparency layer, whatever that is. I'm assuming that's baked into what you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think where we miss on ethical AI is that we don't necessarily offer reasonable accommodations to get out of the AI.
Hmm.
So a question that I'll ask CHROs and heads of talent or business leaders when they're talking about AI related to employment is they'll say, so what do you think our strategy should be? What do you think we should do? As I said, the first thing we're talking about is reasonable accommodations. That is the first thing we're talking about, because no matter what, there's any number of jurisdictions that you have to disclose the use, and then you have to offer something that says, I don't want to be part of this, so assess me or et cetera.
Kind of like GDPR. You opt in or you opt out.
So what's your plan?
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
So if your plan was 100% of our personnel actions are going to be done through artificial intelligence, I will tell you that there are any number of country-based laws that actually prohibit that business decision. So that's where you start. You start that's by cool. declaring reasonable right. accommodations.
Yeah, I like that, Ryan. That's cool.
Okay.
You know. All right.
So interested here to get your take on the role of AI specific to employment practices. What is okay. Andrew Gudomsky's view on this?
So first and foremost, you know, there's different levels of AI. I remember, oh God, I think it was 2016, myself and this employment attorney, Brian Garrison, and I went out to like a recruit con or something. No, it wasn't recruit con. It was literally a law compliance conference in Las Vegas.
Oh, sounds okay. fun.
Oh yeah, that was a hoop. That was like going to HR Tech, right? Same sort of people, right? We're all going out afterwards.
Oh, I need an eight ball.
Yeah. So we did this presentation about the different levels of AI and what the legal impact was. And I think that just like AI is a buzzword.
Right.
So automation is not the same as algorithmic, which is not the same as cognition or pure artificial. So when we talk about employment, and you mentioned paradox primarily, right? You know, and we all, you know, we know a bunch of people over there. I mean, they started out as an automation and waterfall, you know, set of tools. And so that's different than do we think this person is better than the other?
Right. Matching technology or stuff like that.
Yeah, right. So you have similarity matching as a statistical model and as an algorithm, is really old. This is not new stuff. So I think that kind of concept is strong. I want to go ahead and match. I've got a position description. Let me be clear. I have a position description, not a job announcement. Mm-hmm. There's a difference.
Oh, yeah. One's a marketing document.
Big one.
Okay. One's a marketing document. One is it?
Right. So on the inside of the organization where you map right. the knowledge, skills, abilities, and tasks longer term. So this is what, you know, position descriptions are basically parking spots. Job ads are the billboards. And then the person who goes into the parking spot is driving a car, right? So they have the car has a certain set of skills and abilities, and it can go fast or it can go on mountains, whatever it is. But that goes into that spot. That spot and where it is and what it's supposed to be and how much you access it are the knowledge, skills, abilities, and tasks of that position. So you have a CEO, and their job, regardless of who the person is supposed to do X, Y, and Z, just like a CFO is supposed to do. And a project manager is supposed to do things that are different than accountants, right? So once you have those position descriptions, if you want to go ahead and say, I've got a resume, I've got performance management, or I've got some sort of profile within the organization, and I want to do similarity matching between this in-depth position description, which is stable, by the way. That is a wildly stable document. It lasts a long time versus an individual. Great. And so I find that to be really strong in the agency. We're doing that. We're looking at things like, you know, there's any number of work roles and you're looking at cyber incident responders and you're trying, you know, there's a definition of that, which is a niceness right. standard.
Right.
And okay, does this person match up to that? And we use, you know, large language models and that kind of thing. But that's against a very stable document.
Right.
The manager decided to say, these are the three bullet points. And I got to make sure that they install Workday in the next 18 months. And that's what's on the job announcement. I think the job announcement versus the resume is a weak use of AI.
100%.
Weak use.
100%.
Generative AI, you want to go ahead and make up interview questions and you want to make up job announcements and,
sure.
you know, you got employment branding people who want to make 27 versions of the same Facebook post or whatever. Yeah, how about it? I mean, that's
just editing. You and I were at a dinner 100 years ago when you were really doing a lot of great work on the analytics side. And we got into a conversation around data, dirty data, and whether or not practitioners could trust the data.
Yeah.
Which I thought was, I think it was a great conversation for us to have. I wish we would probably broadcast that to other folks, because you're never going to have perfect data. This idea that you're going to be sitting on some type of perfect data and then be able to make perfect decisions, it's just a dumb concept, right?
But yeah.
What I want to bring you back to is not that conversation, because that's old. How much do you hear about that as it relates to AI? And is some of it being data and some of it being trust from practitioners?
So artificial intelligence is a series of statistical models that are, you know, hyped up. And right. So there's training data that comes in. And then if they're really smart about it, they're going to use what are called holdbacks to say, okay, we've trained it with this data, and then we're going to test the models and we're going to pull some of the data out. We're going to, you know, we're going to put some data back in, and then we're going to keep our confidence up, and we're going to look at different statistical models, and we're going to see how much error we have. So that's an old concept, you know, also known as area under the curve, right? So you want to look for the error. If you're doing that. If you're doing that at a baseline, that is the minimum of artificial intelligence. If you're if you're winging it outside of that, like, that's not AI, that's winging it.
It's artificial, not so much intelligence, maybe artificial, what's less than intelligence?
Stupidity. Well, I gotcha.
Yeah. Artificial and stupidity. You know, it's artificial hype, right? It's
artificial hype. All right, very good.
But if you're going ahead and you're doing your training the way you should be, then what you need to do is you need to make sure that the data that's coming in for, say, similarity matching doesn't have its own flaws.
Right.
And I think where we're struggling is, you know, and you got to get past all the blog posts and the LinkedIn, you know, that, oh, this is the greatest solution ever. It's like, you know, it can't be. This is why you need to have human interaction. I think the data veracity in HR is weak.
Right.
Agreed. Thereby, AI outputs are going to have error, or what we're quickly calling hallucinations.
When you say veracity, just as a point of clarity, do you mean literacy? Are you thinking about it from the practitioner perspective? Okay.
So data truth, which is we have a structured set of data, and it says Andrew Gadomski, not Andrea Gadomski.
Right. F name, L name, got it.
Right, that kind of stuff. So it's accurate data, but you know, that's where I think we're seeing with AI is that the things that we might be putting into it as an employer, we're depending upon the service provider that we're using and the training that they executed to line up with the data that we have to come up with the outputs that we want. And I think when I look at organizations and I see, you know, they're like, how many, you know, you look at things like how many interview dates are actually logged in the applicant tracking system and how many are actually accurate.
Right.
And unless you're using an automated tool to do all of that, you're depending upon manual.
Right.
You look at basics like that and you say, well, we don't even have veracity around our normal staffing processes.
Right.
So what are the chances that we've got really strong veracity about stuff that's a lot more complex?
I'm picking up what you're putting down here.
And so it's kind of like, well, and by the way, you know, the matching is all subjective anyway.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So, you know, I think that from a speed perspective, it's great.
But we're loading our own biases into the match.
Right. And, yeah, and we're not even talking about the right things with AI right 100%. Now in employment.
100%.
So we need to kind of, I keep on talking about skipping to the end. So here's the end. The end is within 2 weeks of a job being posted, it's filled. That's the end, right? That's what everybody wants. Everybody wants
And that time period could be 3 weeks, but it could be 2 days. So, but right. the idea is that it opens, it closes.
Right. Yeah.
Got it.
Now, the first problem with where we're going with AI is we're creating an environment where there's no fear of leaving. If I can fill a job in 2 weeks, then I can find one in 2 weeks.
Right.
So the dynamics in the employer change. Because if the employee doesn't have fear of leaving, and then the employer and the manager team, management team have a fear of people leaving at any time, it changes the total dynamics around your culture, how you manage, and those types of things. I haven't seen any of that stuff anywhere other than this podcast right here.
Right.
It's an interesting point. Let's go deeper on that. When did this change happen? When did you start to see this?
Free agency in sports.
Yeah, it's basically, yeah. I'm pretty sure we said this before.
Loyalty
to the employer. It's changed.
Destroyed.
Right.
Yeah.
So
both bi-directional, by the way.
So this is when this started. So this wasn't automated until pretty much. So this is in the part of being automated.
Right.
Where we can see little tools coming up that allow you to, you know, apply to 200 jobs overnight. And
right.
And when we got people who make mistakes where they don't put a limit on how many people come into a job. So you got 1,000 candidates that pop in because they're all using artificial intelligence and to apply. And then the recruiter walks in the morning and it's like, what the heck? And they're like, I can't go through all these people. And they're all moaning about the work that they have to do. And then they say to their boss, well, we need to go ahead and get AI so I can go. I don't have to go through this, when it was just like, okay, just stop and cut it off at 50 applicants. That's all. You just needed to hit the button. Right.
Right. Well, yeah. LinkedIn apply, Indeed apply. We fell in love with volume, both sides.
Oh,
the candidate fell in love with volume because I can just apply to boom. And I remember an era where recruiters would say, hey, I got 10,000 people that applied to the job. Like, they were happy that they had the volume that applied for the job. And it's like, yeah,
we're
applauding the wrong thing.
Then you get down to the 50 people that you looked at and you put them into your community and do all that other crap that never worked. Yeah. Yeah.
So we were talking about when this pivoted. So go back.
He's bringing us back.
About 15 years. What we saw was the ability to increase your annual income was more when you left an organization.
Right. Right.
Versus when you stayed.
That's right.
Correct.
And so, I mean, maybe that's 20 years, but let's just call it 15.
Right.
And that became statistically viable for basically every occupation.
Yeah. You were incentivized to move to another organization.
Right. You were if you wanted to make more, I mean, like literally take it to a family dynamic.
Right.
I have one child, but if I wanted another child, I know how much it costs to have four mouths to feed in a house rather than three.
Right.
So I've got pressure to make more money or cinch my belt. So it made sense to leave an organization to gain more income based on, you know, your own internal pressures, but even just life cycle events. Right. And on top of that, we also, since 1963, we've continually added dual income houses.
Right.
So what's happened is you make more money by leaving and you have two people in a house working, dual income houses. So it becomes fashionable to leave. And now it's turned into, I can leave whenever I want, not just because of money.
Right.
I need to have fair treatment. I need to make sure that I'm well, that I have all the benefits. And that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. So there's no social barrier.
No.
I've been with an organization for two years. And if I leave, I don't have, I can explain why I've left 100 different ways.
Well, you remember how we would talk about gaps in resumes. So we would talk about it for a decade. We were talking about how do you explain the gap in a resume? there is no explanation of a gap in a resume. Who cares? I got two questions. You can handle them any way you want to. One is, are you a buyer or seller of a chief AI officer? That's one.
Okay.
Two, who's best suited to help with compliance around AI? And again, setting some of the boundaries or some of the guardrails, if you will. You and I, pre-show, we talked about politicians and academics. Those, neither of those might be the case. But okay. So one is your bid on the emergence of a potential emergence of a chief AI officer.
Yeah.
What you think about that idea as conceptually. And the other is who should be writing the, who should be helping us with the guardrails of AI?
Okay. So absolutely you should have a chief AI officer if you're an organization that, number one, is in healthcare. Number two, if you're in finance, if you're dealing with any kind of
regulated industry,
public-oriented consumer-based service where data would come in and there's a threat of artificial intelligence tainting that data, right? So there's this weird cross between if you have a CISO, okay, if you have a chief information security officer, you probably need an intelligence officer.
100%.
Okay. Because you're already in a market where you actually said there's all kinds of threat to our organization. So now that means that with artificial intelligence, not only are you using it, you're protecting it against it.
It's not going to be the same skill set, but it needs to be a person that's coordinating their efforts with that.
Right.
Got it.
So I think that, so if you don't have a chief security officer related to information, you might be a little bit less apt to say, well, why do I need an artificial intelligence officer? Probably that's just based on your maturity of an as an organization in terms of what you see as advantages and threats.
Okay.
So I think you need to have one. If you are a vendor, so we'll all lean in here because you guys get heard by a lot of people. If you are on the floor of HR tech and you have a booth and you don't have someone whose job is executing artificial intelligence policy, but you have AI on the back, on the booth or in, no, if it says AI on the squishy ball, okay?
On the socks.
Okay, yes. You need someone you can point to, and I don't care what their title is, and say that position description includes understanding ethical AI, the use of AI, how it develops in our roadmap, and then candidly, what is the competitive landscape, right? So this is an intelligence job.
Right.
What are the things that we could be using or are we not going to use based on this developing technology? So if you're that in the HR tech space, that's my advice there. If you are a head of talent acquisition or a CHRO and you're in one of these larger organizations, your chief artificial intelligence officer probably isn't going to get in your way very much.
Right.
Similar to the way that, you know, Workday is rarely bought by the head of talent acquisition.
Right. 100%. That's rarely bought by the CHRO.
It's bought by the CHRO. So
I said actually opposite. It's rarely bought by the CHRO.
That's right. It's bought by
more often. It's more often bought by the CFO.
Right. So I think that I don't think that there's going to be a lot of engagement between the head of talent acquisition and a chief artificial intelligence officer in the larger corporation. And forgive me, but it's because it's not that important to them.
Right.
Yeah.
It's important to them if it's a de-risking exercise. EU Artificial Intelligence Act, right? Great. If you are a healthcare organization in the state of Maryland, your chief artificial intelligence officer is going to talk to the CHRO because that's a de-risking exercise around employment. And you know, if you've got 7 clinics and you're burning through 3,000 people a year as employees and you're looking at 30, 40, 50,000 applications, yeah, there's a conversation there. Because you need to have, okay, we're using artificial intelligence. Where are we storing the data? Are we getting external observers? Do we have an internal audit? I need to know those things because the CEO is asking me as the chief artificial intelligence officer, how have you increased efficiency and how have you de-risked us? Those are the two things a chief AI officer answers. And the one, the de-risk, is probably more important than the efficiency one.
Right.
And by the way, that whole concept of de-risking, like, it's brand new in HR.
Yeah, but we talk more about the efficiency side. It's more of a comfortable conversation about the efficiency. Like, oh, this right. is going to make it efficient. But risk is boring because it gets bored. It's get back to compliance. Like HR is compliance. Period. End of story. But people are bored by compliance. But it's the stuff that makes HR HR. Yeah. And so I think the de-risking is a great conversation.
You had a second question. So the first one was, do you need a chief AI officer? And then the second one, which I didn't skip over, I just haven't gotten to yet, is?
Guardrails.
What are the guardrails you need to have?
Who's best suited to create the guardrails?
Okay. You're talking about employment now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a couple Lawyers? Of things. So there's a couple of things that influence that.
Right.
If you're a global employer and you've got thousands of people, you need to have guardrails that are educated by the CHRO once they're informed, as this is a de-risking exercise for our organization. And that is important for not only the CEO to know, but the board to know. And the reason being is you talk about de-risking and you talk about legislation and you talk about workforce efficiency, not just you talk about to the board, but you're talking about it to the SEC and you're talking to it about the regulators inside mm-hmm. the EU around corporate sustainability and responsibility. Right. So that's a big strategic conversation, right? So the guardrails start with HR, and they're informed by legal organization, and they're informed by auditors who are independent, who are looking at the data, right? And they can be informed by their heads of talent and their heads of org design and that sort of thing. So it starts with the CHRO. It probably ends with investor relations and says, we are responsible.
Yeah.
We are following the rules, and that makes us a better, report. More innovative workforce right. that retains people better, so we have less risk.
Right.
And that's why you should invest in us.
That tracks for me.
Right.
Ryan, what do you got?
I like it. I like the answer. I got nothing else to add here, man. Andrew, go ahead. Outside do you have one more?
Outside of the guardrails of like who's going to create the laws. Like we talked about the EU and what they're doing. And we've talked about some of the things that our country is doing, both federal, state, municipal, et cetera. My fear is politicians are going to write a lot of that stuff, maybe even be impacted by industry and probably some tech giants, et cetera. But my fear is like a lot of things, I don't see politicians writing the things that need to be written. And so I would rather that be done by a think tank or be done by academics to write those.
Yeah, now, I hear you. It's
but
too
I don't
late.
Agree with you.
I'm about to pat on the head.
And so we're already in an era of what's known as the Brussels effect. So because the EU right. and the team in Brussels has launched this as much as 3 years ago, right. the die is cast.
Okay.
Right? So the UK is matching up legislation. India right. has matching up legislation. China published a 300-page strategy around artificial intelligence for the next 30 years and $300 trillion of estimated revenue. I think it's $300 trillion over the next like 50 years. Some crazy number. And I stopped reading after about page 60. I'm like, okay, this is well, like, yeah. I don't need to get into this. So we've already got the major market players already talking about artificial intelligence and how they're going to govern it. So, right. I mean, who is it? Senator Casey here in the United States. I think it's Senator Casey. You know, I haven't had enough coffee today. He's got a bill that's been drafted. No one's talking about this. He's got a bill that's a federal bill that's been drafted talking about AI governance specifically in employment.
Wow.
And all it says is follow the rules of the EEOC. So it reinforces
interesting
all of the EEOC laws and says, well, why don't we just pass a law that says all AI that talks about advancement and everything else follows these laws.
Right.
Which
seems basic. It's
kind of like having like an agency like OSHA. Right? Yeah. It's like, yes, we're not supposed to, you know, the only the Joker jumps into the chemical vat.
Try not to kill your employees.
Right. There you go. Like it's like, hard. Okay, we're gonna like write some rules down because some of these rules are already there, but we're just going to go ahead and blanket it. I mean, if you listen to, you know, if you listen to the EEOC commissioner, he's all over the place, by the way.
Right.
So Keith is out there talking, hey, we've already got these things on the books. And running an audit, following the rules, using AI might make it better for you. That's fine. And he's right. You got to follow the rules. And if you're using AI, it helps you reinforce the fact that you're following the rules, that's cool. I think having if you look at what the president's come out with around artificial intelligence and governance and guidance,
right.
It basically says, do the right thing, right? Don't.
Nice.
It basically says, do the right thing. This federal drafted bill is basically saying, we're applying AI to employment, saying, continue to do the right thing, but prove it.
Aye.
Right? And that's basically what the EU has said. EU has said you got to have either smart people or external people looking at your data saying, are you doing the right thing? New York was bold enough to say you absolutely need to have an internal independent auditor.
Right.
Of course, you know, about 7 companies have complied with that. You know, but, you know, I think it's, again, you know, everyone's not thinking about this stuff as a compliance risk.
Right. Dumb question alert. The NLRB, I've always thought of the NLRB shifting with political who's in office. So if a Republican's in office, okay, it goes one way. A Democrat's in office, it goes another way. In my mind, I've kind of put the EEOC in a similar vein, that it just depends on who's in office as to what gets enforced. The laws might be the laws, but whether or not we're actually going to put agents on it and enforce it seems to me, at least, to be political or weaponized in that way. I said it was a dumb question alert. So do I have that wrong?
Okay, so this is what I will tell you about government and its missions.
Okay.
Mission changes based on where the risk is, right. Where the risk is for the United States. Okay.
Right.
So if the risk is increasing for, say, certain types of discrimination, we will execute the government will probably execute more resources towards right. that, more budget towards that. So here's a great example. Okay. We haven't been talking about hate speech a lot until a few years ago. And right. then it became around, okay, houses of worship are being attacked or under threat. So then what you'd have to do is you start budgeting towards that. I mean, it's no different than, you know, look at the TSA. Great example. Before 9/11, you know, I could have walked through
didn't matter.
With anything. 100%. So we shift based on the environment and the conditions. I think where we are with the EEOC is that we're paying very close attention to discriminatory acts.
Right.
One, because we have more people in the workforce. Two, because we have people staying in the workforce longer. And then three, we've naturally spread into other urban areas. So
right.
There's this concept of, well, I live in a place where I'm part of an underserved population, and I'm feeling discriminated against. So there's more recording of that, more documenting of that. And you have to realize that before we were using paper to make complaints.
Right.
Now I can go on my phone and I can swipe right and make a complaint.
Right.
So I agree with you that things will sway. I don't think that's necessarily I don't think that's linked to right. the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's hard to link it to the legislative branch.
Right.
But I think what happens is the legislature, if there's a problem in California and it's getting a lot of noise in California, the members of the House and the Senate in California will start to pay more attention to it.
Right.
Right.
It's probably true of New York in some ways, that it pushes to the middle. If something happens in either of those two areas, it probably Andrew, we've kept you too long, and we could talk to you forever. turns out you've got like a job and stuff to do. So
yeah, stuff to do.
I've got a job and a business.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, brother. We absolutely appreciate you.
My yes, pleasure. Sir. I appreciate you guys inviting me on. And hey, let me thank you. By the way, so not just for inviting me, your words, your leadership, your advocacy in our space is longstanding. I feel very blessed and honored to have these dialogues with you. But thank you so much for continuing to push our industry, HR, to think differently. So thank you.